And I think it would be very nice to get question from the audience. And you know, now we have heard a lot of discussion and a little further elaboration. So please, anyone who wants to pose a question or a thought down there.
Perfect. Okay, my name is Lennart Wohlgemuth, Gothenburg University. I think it, first of all, this is a very interesting and very good way of trying to use policy advice from the research taking place in Sweden. So I think this question about thesis presentation is a very good one. The problem with thesis presentation is that by, to choose a doctor thesis means that you have to concentrate, you have to focus. And there are a lot of questions that we should ask you, but they are outside the what you are doing. So when you, for example, when you talk about participation in the constitutional process, then of course my first question would be, that is quite limited. In order to be able to pursue participation, then of course participation has also to be implemented in the process of implementing the constitution. So if you take South Africa, which you mentioned, I mean, the perhaps most important part of South Africa was that they had a fantastic participation, a fantastic constitution, but that they also have, at least up to date, been able to implement a participatory process also in upholding the constitutional process. And that is the only way of really measuring if participation is. The same way when you talked about extremely important question about impunity as you explained, particularly from Burundi. The next question that one would ask, want to ask, but that is also outside the what you wanted to look at, is the real difficult question of balancing the impunity questions with reconciliation. Yeah. Because that is really the problem. I guess that in upholding the reason why there has been so much impunity is that they have looked more into the reconciliation, and that have weighed more in that. So, I mean, the problem is in drawing the conclusions that we have to widen the discussion. But taking all your four pieces jointly, I think this really is a very strong view. I think it was Yinyut that you didn't present them one by one, because I mean you can see now conflict out of four particularly different perspectives, and jointly this is very strong. And I mean someone should now try to add this together and make one presentation out of the whole. Thank you very much for very good presentations.
Thank you. That was more kind of important reflection, which relates a little bit to that. I was interested also to hear how you, when you hear the other one, which deals with related issues, how you frame your work in relationship to the other ones and how it strengthens and builds on other aspects. But maybe we can come back to later on and invite the audience for further questions. Yeah, the microphone is coming.
Thank you very much. My name is Mikael Lindgren, and I'm working with the Church of Sweden. And a two-folded question about civil society. One would be a bit general, but you can see what you can give back. Regarding in your work, in your research work, the findings you've had about what kind of civil society actors that have been sort of allies or part of the problem. In your different focus, very general. The other one is more to us, civil society in Sweden or internationally, involved in cooperation, sort of thinking about trying to be conflict sensitive and so on, to how to not only, like you asked for, like what we should do, but also to say what we should not do. So, it's also very broad, but from your findings, suggestions like how to avoid to make things worse and hopefully contribute to something.
Thank you. Who wants to begin taking on that one?
Jan? I think that one problem when it comes to civil society actors is that, and this also relates to the funders, that it goes very strong trends in what people are doing. So that when it comes to local communal conflicts now, that's has been a focused area. So it's many groups who say that, okay, we are dealing with this issue, because then they are able to get funds from different organizations. And then it might be the same advice again, that that's not their prime speciality. So then they might be maybe in a field that they are not fully specified to do. And I've seen that in both the Darfur and in South Sudan, you have had very many organizations working with local peace building. And they have often come in without very little knowledge about the context. So then they have signed some kind of peace agreement between the different actors. But they have, might have been dealing with the wrong actors. So it's like to... It's often been a case where someone claims that I'm the traditional leader of this group, and then an NGO invites him to sit on the table, and they are there for a while. And I've also heard in interviews, people have said that we had this discussion, and then we realized that we didn't have gender in our peace agreement, so we put it in to please the NGOs. And it's also several cases where these actors has not been what the communities perceive as their representatives. So again, you really need to really understand if you are dealing with the right actors. Are the people here the one that they state that they are? And in many cases, this has had a negative effect, because people have lost trust in these local peace-building processes, which are extremely good when they work. But if you have 15 of them and 13 of them don't work, then it creates a problem for the entire system.
It's just a little bit, it's interesting, Suyuan's experience in Sudan and in Burundi, the civil society organizations that I met with that are working on sexual violence and documenting sexual violence had there are two sort of sides to it. One is that there would be human rights organizations that wanted to document human rights violence in general, but because donors were so keen to fund sexual violence activities, then they built in sexual violence as a kind of incident to record and pay attention to. And the result was sort of mixed. On one hand, it was good because it helped sensitize people. And the limited information I have on Burundi is partly a result of that you know, the international community sort of forced sexual violence onto a number of human rights organizations that would not have wanted to or known how or had the expertise to document it. But it's not always well documented, and there's a real problem, a capacity gap. And the other side is that there are women's organizations that then could... I don't want to be harsh, but to sort of exaggerate the levels of sexual violence and the link between sexual violence in Burundi today or in the last few years with the war, because again, it's topical. And so you get a really mixed picture of what reality really is. On the one hand, it's become much more people know and understand the consequences of sexual violence in Burundi. But on the other hand, there's a sense that it's endemic and widespread, and we don't really know how endemic and widespread it is. So, I mean, I think that we should try and really support civil society pushing when we can, but we should match that with capacity, with sensitivity to the real needs on the ground. And just one other side, with regards to sexual violence, on the other side of it, the police services now have more and more people who are reporting sexual violence, more and more victims, and they, because it's become much more sensitized and people are less ashamed to come forward who've been violated, but then the police don't have the capacity to address the rising number of cases. So there are these kinds of unintended consequences.
Can you just follow up on what you were just... talk about now. How do you see the work, sort of the preventive work with boys and men towards sexual violence and also, you know, further gender equality?
I think actually it's incredibly important and essential. In FNL ex-combatants, some of them self-organize to protect their communities and to sort of prevent things like sexual violence, but other sort of, you know, petty crimes. And, you know, there is sensitivity. It's very interesting because for a long time, I think MSF, which was treating a lot of victims of sexual violence, thought there was no word for rape in Kirundi, but there is a word for it. It's just a different word with a different definition and scope. And it was just very interesting I mostly worked with men who were, maybe some of them were perpetrators, maybe some of them were not. But in focus group work, they would talk about this, and some men would talk about the impact it had on them to have a relative or a child affected. And they were then becoming sort of, to use a little bit of a cheesy word, champions for women's equality, but it in a really organic and natural way. Yeah.
Maggie, you were on the way to, was there something you, from your perspective, you wanted to?
Sure. You asked about civil society, and I was thinking about it. And in terms of local civil society in Colombia, they've been immensely helpful and very knowledgeable in pinpointing systemic corruption and so forth. Swedish civil society has been at times, for instance, when the AUC were demobilized, going back to this issue with impunity we keep returning to, Sweden supported the program of reintegrating paramilitaries, which was quite harshly criticized, precisely because that entailed de facto impunity for very, very gross human rights violations. Only thing being that if these amnesties or transitional justice measures were not in place, in all likelihood, armed groups in Colombia and elsewhere, I suspect, are not very likely to hand in their arms and their uniforms in return for a prison cell. So it's always this kind of, I don't want to condone impunity, but it is very much a peace versus justice trade-off. And I'm not sure the same thing will happen now when FARC demobilizes. They're probably going to get a very similar treatment, but for some reason, I don't think the criticism will be quite as harsh, I hope.
Thank you. Yes, other questions? We start behind. Yep, the microphone's coming.
Thank you very much. My sort of invite to discussion is mainly for Angela Mugunda Sellström, and I really want to congratulate you on what seems to me, I only sort of skimmed your paper here, but it seems to me that provides a lot of counterintuitive and complex insights that could be very useful for policy work in the future. I do not know Africa, so my comments or questions will be somewhat generic, but I'm now based here at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs, but in a previous existence I worked on sexualized violence during World War II in East Asia, in Japan primarily. So my first sort of observation or question has to do with sort of the setup of your research. It seems to me that you're dealing with at least two, possibly more, maybe three or four different sort of legal structures in the research. One then working or looking at the sort of existing legal frameworks for when this war happens, and then in combination, of course, with the code of conduct of the guerrilla groups or the armed groups that you're dealing with. So existing laws at the time of the crime. And then the other sort of implementation or post-conflict application of these or ways to step away from them. And so it seems to me that you're really dealing with a quite interesting cycle of why men rape or what are the possibilities for committing sexualized violence, and then linked to what happens after you have committed a crime of sexualized violence, and then how that feeds back to these conditions that started the cycle. And so my question is, what sort of policy implications could be drawn from that in terms of how conventions and laws are written, or are the conventions and laws specific, and then how would one go about after that? And then my second sort of point, and I will try to be brief, it has to deal with the genesis that I understand is not the focus of your paper, but I was very taken by the fact that you don't seem to anywhere mention the very hegemonic sort of analysis that sexualized violence happens in war as a tactic of war, or as our foreign minister now speaks of it increasingly as a tactic of terror. And I like this in your research. I'm not sure if I'm correct about it, but I think it's important that we leave the possibility for the analysis that sexualized violence happens for a number of different reasons. And in my own research,
there are a lot of questions. There are a lot of hands, so
okay.
We need to.
So I will limit it then to the tactics of war being there or not. Do you see any sort of importance of pronouncing it a tactics of war? Or is it equally important to fight sexualized violence in wartime, no matter what the motifs or the sort of back underlying reasons are?
Thank you. I ask you a little bit to wait a little bit for answering a question. We need to take up several, otherwise we will not have a time. And here is what was one, and then I saw at least one more. So please. And here the microphone is coming there. Oh, we can take this one here. You can take that one.
Thank you very much. We know that there's a big gap between academia and policy. And I myself have transitioned that gap in a way, but I want to thank Eba for arranging this seminar. So to get us policymakers a chance to hear out your findings. My name is Chris Coulter. I'm with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs Security Policy Department. First of all, let me just say that our Minister of Development, Isabella Lövin, have just, this year, said that all Swedish development aid will be underpinned by a conflict analysis. And that's actually a direct result of some of the research that have come out of the very departments represented here today. So academia and research does matter. My second question is for Mikael, and I'm sure that you know what I'm going to ask. In your research, did you also interview FARC men and women? And if you break it down, if you do sort of sex disaggregated data on your findings, were there any differences in reasons for joining or reasons for demobilizing? Thank you.
Thank you. And also remember the question, and then we had a third one. And was it a fourth as well?
Thank you very much. I agree with what has been said about the value of these presentations. I think this is very useful. And also express the appreciation for engaging with policy issues and policy matters from a research perspective, because that's not always the case. I'm Per Nordlund, and I work at CEDA. One general comment and then a little bit more of a specific question institutional processes, perhaps. I think what you have discussed here illustrate what we, it's a tendency, when we do development cooperation, we have a tendency that there's a tension between peace building, humanitarian assistance on one side, and then the more long-term development cooperation on the other side. And then in the first, there's a sense of urgency, you need to solve an urgent situation. In the second, there is a more of a long-term perspective. But that sense of urgency sometimes spills over into the more long-term development cooperation aspects. And I think we now have an international evaluation of the New Deal for Engagement in Fragile States initiative, which sort of frames many of the cases that you have been looking at. And I think that is a very useful exercise to do that evaluation. But I think your research as well will serve as a useful input in that discussion, because these are really hard issues. There are good arguments to solve things quickly in some of these cases, but there are also very good arguments not to do harm. And if we are going to be successful in not doing harm, we need to know have detailed political economy analysis of those contexts. And sometimes we don't have that time. We rush the fragility assessment from the donor side in Somalia, for example. We're moving ahead quickly with elections in Somalia. This may be good, it may be not so good, but these are the kind of issues that we struggle with. On the other aspect of the constitutional processes, we end up with Freedom House, yes, but it's a rather blunt instrument. Did you have a chance to disaggregate and look at sort of political rights, civil liberties aspects of that index? And also, it's not the strongest index in terms of participatory aspects or discursive aspects of democracy. So are there, and this is perhaps more general for all of you, are there in these DDR processes aspect that relates not to the political institutions and the states, but perhaps to the political culture and the aspects of tolerance and trust, not in institutions, but in interpersonal trust or intercommunal trust. You have Afrobarometer data on compare Zimbabwe and Kenya on the political institutions, but what about the sort of interpersonal, intercommunal trust issues? Were there any effects there before and after?
Okay. We'll start now with the Angela's, the first question you, which was specifically on you, and try to rather short answers.
Okay, very short. Thank you very much. I didn't get your name, but I'll say hi later. You are correct that there are various different legal processes and frameworks. So there's the internal framework and the sort of national framework. There's also a traditional framework in terms of traditional culture about, for example, forced marriage and sexualized violence in that context. And then there's also the international legal framework and the post-war legal framework, which is heavily influenced by international covenants and legal kind of the international legal framework. And the problem is that on different levels within Burundian society, these have different values and different effects. So, and at different times. So during the conflict, for most combatants, I'm talking about the vast majority from mid-level to foot soldier, only the code of conduct within the armed group mattered. And what I think I'm trying to argue, and what I hope comes out in the dissertation, is that that code of conduct is much, much more important in terms of changing, affecting attitudes than the international legal framework, because political elites might sign on to that, but they don't. I mean, I show that there's a lack of information flowing down, and that's important. And then on the second point, it's a very, very, very big point, and I think many people here will say yes. Maria Eriksson Bas, for example, has written about the fact that, you know, not all sexual violence during conflict is tactical or strategic or is a weapon of war. So there's a great variation, and there are a number of causes, and I think that that's super important. Obviously, you could probably do a typology of armed actors and say ISIS is definitely using sexual violence as a tactic, but there are small other groups that don't. And it's very important if we're going to find the right policy response to understand that there is that variation.
Thank you. And the next question was specifically for Mika.
Mm. Okay, short question to Chris's question. Yes, I interviewed men and women at the outset of why people join. I don't think it differs so much. On average, women who join tend to be a little younger, tend to be more likely to have a relationship with one of the already existing fighters and so forth. Once they enter, it's quite different, because Colombian is a very unequal society in terms of gender relations, whereas FARC formally, officially, nominally, is gender equal. It's not true all the way, but it's quite common for women who had no position of power or influence or standing in society to become mid-level commanders. They're leading 6 or 12 or 24 men into battle. And we ask people what. So there's a range of negative experiences of being a member of the guerrilla. Sometimes when you ask female combatants, was there anything good about it? And they said, yes, this sense of influence, this sense of almost having a career path. I know how strange this sounds in this setting, but so there's a different experience inside, not so much in joining, but when you're a member. Also when leaving the group, because female ex-combatants, at least anecdotally, tend to feel much more stigmatized by society. So once they're outside, as soon as they... Not generalizing universally, but much more likely to exit from the DDR program because they don't want to be seen in society as a former fighter, because outside in civil society, that's more much more negative than being a male former fighter, if I generalize and simplify.
Johan wanted to add something in relation related to this, and then we take Abra. No, it was not that one. Okay, it was okay. Then the start, Abra. The question with participation was rather rightly to you.
Thank you for your question. I think that you have a good point, and absolutely it's true. I mean, there's always the thing about trying to strike a balance between short-term objectives, which is ending violence and conflict, and reconciling this with long-term aims. In terms of constitution building, I would propose, I mean, instead of suggesting that people in these countries should include the public in making a new constitution directly after conflict, why not propose an interim constitution that you have for a number of years while things settle down a bit, and then you can, during the course of time, when feelings aren't so heated, write a permanent constitution. Because, I mean, a constitution, you shouldn't change it every year. I mean, it should be a constant document, more or less. In terms of, I mean, Freedom House, I mean, these democracy data, as we can discuss forever and ever. I haven't disaggregated Freedom House, but I've cross-checked the data with Polity, and the results are basically the same, which they usually are. And I mean, in the comparative democratization literature, these indexes are sort of the best thing we have presently, while we wait for the VDEM at Gothenburg to be finished.
Yeah.
Thank you. And you wanted to...
Just a very general comment. And I mean, I think that often we end up in this strong positioning between the academics and the policy research. I think this is a great opportunity to meet. And I think that also... happy to hear this about the conflict analysis. But I think that one general theme that we have, all of us said, have been this with the understanding the local complexities. And then I also think that policy actors and NGOs should think about what institutional structures on their side that disable them to grasp these local conditions. Because I see this up from United Nations down to different NGOs. And for instance, we at the department received funding from a policy actor to write a report. And then we were going to have a seminar about that. The seminar was never held, and I'm pretty sure that no one read the report at that, even though they funded it. And of course, that's not because they are not interested in it, but probably have too many things that they are doing or whatever. So, I mean, to really think about... how can we change structure so that enables that? And I mean, I've met great people working for the UN and different NGOs, but just as a, they have often been very long in these countries. So I think that one recommendation could be that people should not shift where they are located every third year, because then it almost makes it impossible to get to the very detailed knowledge that often is needed.
And thank you. And that leads over to what I was also going to ask here, because we need to wrap up here. And we have now, during the seminar, forced you a little bit to think about from your research setting and specifically a dissertation, which is a very long process, to think about the policy conclusions. So now I'm turning to Annika and Mimmi to what are you taking with you from this discussion about the research and the relationship to the policy work you are working with? So, and again, rather short message. What were you thinking?
Right. Okay, three small things. One, I think I want to continue where I started off to say I think this shows, and the work by these excellent researchers shows, the role of research and how relevant it is to the work that we do in the policy world. And I think that's so I want to encourage this initiative. Secondly, I also want to... another thing that I think comes out very clearly is that, and something that alludes to what you said, Angela, is that I think we should be much more careful in thinking about the outcomes that we're interested in and that we want to see. How do we actually arrive at that without just saying that if we want to have justice, we do encourage transitional justice. If we want to have reintegration, let's have a DDR program. But rather to think about what sort of different things that we put in place actually leads to the outcome, with being without sort of jumping immediately to a program that is on that. So creating accountability, let's say, for example, doesn't necessarily come in certain societies from having some sort of strange state-building process that we haven't had elsewhere. It might come through forcing taxation programs. That sort of taxation creates accountability even in other states, because that's how it's created here, but also we've seen local work in, for example, neighborhoods of Lagos where this has worked perfectly. So it doesn't have to do with just an historical fact. And then lastly, I want to say, and it alludes to what you said, Yuan, I think it is possible, it doesn't have to be a contradiction between saying that we need to look at the specifics of certain countries and processes and actors, but also do have generalized from that. I don't think they necessarily have to stand against each other, and I think you made a great point about that. We can still learn a lot from those specifics. Thank you.
Thank you. Annika?
Thank you. Thank you for a very interesting discussion to all the dissertation writers. I as well... take away the importance of having discussions like this, where academia meets policy, and where we see the need for research and analysis to inform policy and to also show the complexities, and in particular that outcomes are context specific, that you need to understand the context where you're in, and therefore the importance for us in development cooperation to do that analysis in the regions and countries that we are working. I also take away sort of the importance of not just looking at symptoms, but what you are saying, that really trying to get down and doing diagnostics and finding out what are the causes, and in that way trying can design the best intervention. Your dissertations all deal with different issues, of course, but I also think I take away, you know, sort of the role of civil society, the role of people participating in these processes as very important. And also thinking about if we look at what's happening in the world right now with the shrinking space for civil society, what is that going to mean for these peace processes going forward? Is another takeaway. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the time is ending for us to be here. And I thank everyone for joining here and for an interesting discussion. And I will just make a little bit advice that the next EBA seminar will be held at the 23rd of October at Rosenbad. And there it is a report on a potential role for aid for work on entrepreneurships in Africa, which will be in focus. And registration is open at the homepage. So you're very welcome back for this try to work in the area in between policy and research. And for those who want to continue this discussion, we cannot stay in here because they're closing this room. But everyone who would like to join for a drink at the restaurant M5, it's for your own expense, but it's a possibility to continue the discussion. And otherwise, I say thank you very much for coming here and for a very interesting discussion. Thank you.